just getting kind of wild with it on Father's Day morning for much of the, well, it is now on the West Coast as well. Look at that. Well, also happy Father's Day, everybody. We're talking with Dr. John Casti. His new book, X Events, The Collapse of Everything. Hidden Catastrophes Looming. But he's written a lot of other books, too, and I'm going to try and draw a correlation. I'm going to try when we return on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. John Casti, author of many books, including the latest X Events, The Collapse of Everything. Dr. Casti, let me see if I can set this up in as linear a fashion as I can. As I go through the contents of X Events, the widespread failure of the internet, breakdown of the global food supply, continent-wide EMP, destroys all electronics, collapse of globalization, exotic particles might destroy the Earth, destabilization of the nuclear landscape, meaning somebody lets one off and we weren't expecting it, drying up the world's oil supplies. Now, I know we're talking about X Events tonight, but one of your other works, the Mood Matters that you mentioned earlier, it makes the radical assertion that all social events, ranging from fashions and music and art to the rise and fall of civilizations, are based on attitudes a society holds toward the future. So my question is, I remember reading a book when I was a kid, elementary school, The City Underground, where, you know, the main character is another kid and wants a hot and sweet beverage. So he just puts hot and sweet in, and there's no telling what he gets, but whatever it is, it's satisfactory. And the society is very organized, very wonderful, but it's unsatisfactory, and there are some sinister aspects to it. So the object is to get out of the city underground and get up to the surface where you can take some risks and live like a human being. And when we look at the literature, when you mentioned art and fashions and music and art, I presume by art you also mean literature and maybe cinematography or filmmaking. These depictions of the future are mostly really sinister and kind of like unpleasant, where we have evolved into these extremely intelligent creatures, but if you were to view us in your 21st century, early 21st century context, we would seem like morons, and only when you got to know us would you realize that we are extraordinarily intelligent and capable of many things. It's like, oh boy, who wants to be one of those people? So are we creating these X events because so many depictions of the future were so grim that we've actually created this internet now that everything runs over, from the telephones to the computers to the banking, all these financial transactions? Do we somehow subconsciously know we're setting a bear trap for ourselves, and it's just a matter of time before we basically voluntarily, because we keep this system alive, step into the thing?
Well, I wouldn't take such a, I would call it, pessimistic view. I think that, you mentioned my previous book, Mood Matters. In that book, I did talk about things like how trends in fashion, art, music, films, and so on change depending upon the mood, the beliefs, if you like, of a population about its future. And I showed in that story that when people are optimistic about the future, when they're looking forward to tomorrow, they think tomorrow will be better than today, then you tend to get the kinds of social events that I would give labels, everyday word labels to, like happy, joining, globalizing, welcoming, and so on. So the positive things that are kind of, you'd even say, nice, that you welcome. On the other hand, when the general beliefs about the future shift to the negative, and people are fearful of the future, thinking tomorrow will be worse than today, then you get just the opposite. You tend to get events that, instead of joining, they have separating. Events that, instead of global, they become localizing. Instead of happy, they're sad. Instead of welcoming, you get xenophobia and so forth. And these kinds of patterns, positive social mood, in negative social mood, or back to positive, they go in cycles. And these cycles have different time scales associated with them. And this is why, if you talk about events in popular culture, like, you know, fashions, kinds of movies that people will like, the kind of books that they want to read, and so on. These are rather short time scale events. They unfold over a period of a few months to a year or so. And so if you want to get some insight into the popular culture, what people are going to like or not like in next year, then you have to look at how trends change over a period of months. It doesn't do you any good to look at long-term trends that change over, let's say, years or decades. On the other hand, if you go to the other end of the scale, talk about the rise or fall of a civilization or even a nation-state, this is a process that unfolds over many, many decades, if not centuries. And so you don't look at how the mood is shifting, how the beliefs are shifting on a day-to-day basis to get an insight into civilization. You have to look on the much longer time scale. So that's the story that's told in that book, Mood Matters. And I would say, and I did say this earlier, my book, X Events, my current book, it's a kind of follow-on to Mood Matters. It's sort of the second volume of a kind of unfolding, maybe trilogy, maybe tetralogy, I'm not sure yet. But it wasn't planned that way. It's just that that's the way my thoughts unfolded over the last few years. And I think that we do not necessarily cause these events. And I emphasize that point in Mood Matters. The psychological state of a population is not a causal factor of what does or doesn't happen, but it strongly biases. It's a biasing factor. It's like weather forecasting. If you look at the current pattern of temperature, wind velocities, humidity, and so on, that pattern will allow many possible weather tomorrow. But not all of those possible weather patterns tomorrow are equally likely. So some of them are just much more likely than others, and that's what I mean by biasing. It doesn't mean you can't have a snowstorm tomorrow here in Vienna, even though right now it's probably around 80 degrees out, but it's unlikely. So this is what I mean by the biasing factor. And so, yes, human beliefs have a strong influence on what happens, but in fact, what really happens is a combination of, I would call it, context and randomness. There's the playing field, the environment within which events unfold, which is always changing. So sometimes you might be at a peak, and then that very same location may later turn into a plateau. And at some point, a random event, something that cannot be predicted, takes place, and it pushes you on that surface to some other place. Now, if you're sitting on a plateau, where you get pushed to is not very far away from where you are today. But if you're sitting on a very sharp peak, even a small push can send you into tumbling into a deep valley somewhere. So this is the kind of, let's say, mental metaphor that I have for how events actually unfold and the role that human volition, if you like, plays in what actually does or doesn't happen.
Well, the reason that I asked that question, of course, is that for so many years we saw visualize world peace bumper stickers.
Yes.
And I stopped seeing them because I guess they thought, oh, take the sticker off. It's not working really well, you know?
Yeah, well, it went out of fashion, let's put it that way. People started believing in something else. And how about, like, visualize survival?
Well, yeah, and, you know, when we get into stuff like this, certainly some people are going to go, you guys are doomsayers. This is gloom and doom, apocalyptic, no way out stuff. But if you're aware of it, at least you've got a chance of avoiding it. What appears to you to be the one that's got your attention the most the virtually certain?
Excuse me, you mean that list of things that I talk about in my book, X Events?
Yeah, you know, it's like we don't want to scare everybody to death because you know, a lot of people already are. This economic thing, we know that if now that everything is so interconnected, if one goes down, it won't collapse the whole system necessarily, but it'll be like pulling a bed sheet. If you pull at the corner, the whole thing moves. And you know, there are a lot of people that have been driven into starvation virtually.
Yeah.
And so what's the one that gets your attention as being the one that we need to watch the closest and try and get ahead of?
Well, first of all, let me say just a word about that list. And the 11 items that I put on that list, ranging from a collapse of the internet to a global deflation, which is number 11, they're not on that list in any particular order. So you should don't read anything into the order in which they appear. In fact, that was a big question of discussion between my editor for the book and myself as to how should we put these things into this section. Because that second section of the book where these 11 mini chapters reside, it was there really to just, these things are just to illustrate the point, the basic idea that's brought forth in part one of the book. And then after you see all these different examples, you see this idea of complexity overload in action in all these different contexts, then the third section of the book really sort of summarizes, well, what do we learn and what can we do? I think it's basically the question you're asking right now. What can we do? And I think that in general, most of the X events are ones that are, if the way that they can happen is such that there's not much that you can do to prevent it entirely, but I think you can soften the blow, you can mitigate the impact of the event. And let me give you an example. It doesn't have to be one of the items on my list, but it's a good familiar example. Think about a hurricane. Think about if you live down in the Gulf Coast. Well, you can get some pretty good early warning indicators if a hurricane is coming in your direction. Now, the one thing you certainly cannot do, you can't prevent it from occurring, but you can certainly take steps to ensure that you're a survivor. And people do this all the time. And you see on TV people, you know, buying up plywood sheets to nail over their windows and flashlight batteries and bottles of fresh water and stuff to go down in their cellar so that they can survive this event. And they usually do. I mean, some don't. But generally speaking, people survive and they come out to live another day. And so I think that many of those X events on my list, even though you can say that they are human-caused, and they are, the underlying cause, this complexity overload, it's somehow wired into human nature. And I think the only way you ultimately eliminate it is you have to sort of reprogram human nature. And I don't expect to see that happen anytime soon. And as a sort of an aside, I'll say that I think that that's part of the reason why you don't see any more bumper stickers saying visualize world peace. It's just not in the human scheme of things. And one might decry that. One might say, well, why not? You know, why can't we change ourselves and so on and so forth? And the answer is not that it can't be done. It's to just look at the record, and it hasn't been done. And it doesn't seem the way to bet, let's put it that way. I don't think it's impossible, but it's not the way to bet. So getting back then to the question of those 11 X events on my list in part two of my book, the ones that I would worry about the most, they are events that unfold on very different timescales, if they were ever to happen at all. You know, the unfolding of a global deflation in the economic sphere, it would be something that would unfold over months or years, not overnight. An electromagnetic pulse can shut down all electronics in all of the United States in a millisecond or two. So, I mean, the timescales are radically different. But the one that I personally find the most disconcerting is a nuclear attack. Either by terrorism or miscalculation on the part of some nuclear power or whatever. I think this is the one that I worry about the most, because I think it's the combination of something that can happen quickly and with hugely devastating effects.
You mentioned the decline and fall of the European Union. If this were to happen, disparity between the people who, between the haves and the have-nots, that's always been an issue. And sooner or later, the people get their torches and their pitchforks and march to the palace, try and get a few more shekels.
Yeah.
So if the European Union were to collapse, what form would that take? What would it look like?
Yeah, well, that's the big question, in my mind anyway. I mean, and I've thought this for, and I even have been writing about it for the last half dozen years or so, that the European Union, in my opinion, is a kind of, it was an experiment that had to be tried. But ultimately, I think it will end up being described in the history books as a kind of noble failure. And the underlying reason is essentially, again, I'll call it complexity overload, too many cultures squeezed into too small a space. And these cultures come into conflict, and these cultures are part of the basic human nature, if you like, of the people in this part of the world, and they're not in harmony. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, diversification is a great thing. It is a great thing to a degree, but it has to be, in some sense, regulated. And if it's unregulated, then you can have runaway complexity. And the European Union is now in this state. So I don't think that there's much question in my mind about whether it will survive or not survive. It will not survive in its current form. So your question is the right one. When it comes apart, what form will it take? Will it be a kind of separation into the rich and the poor, north and south? Will it be separated out into independent groups that are sort of culturally connected, like the Scandinavians in one group, the Spanish Italians in another group, the Germanic northern countries, Germany, Netherlands, Austria in another group? Or will it just completely come undone, like, and go back more or less to the boundaries that were in place before it started decades ago? I could make an argument for each one of those, and I think I did in my book X Events. But the ultimate resolution, I think it may end up being determined by one of those what I call random events that pushes the system in a certain direction when it's in a critical state and can be easily moved to one valley as opposed to another.
And I realize you're not an economist.
Not by training.
Right. But, you're a thinking man, and you have a very tall forehead, and so I know there's a brain in there that makes these calculations. You also have a PhD in mathematics, which is amazing. How does this work when you have these different levels? I don't want to get boring with the economics here, but I don't get this. These different countries that make up the European Union, they have different levels of productivity. It looks to me like the Germans have been carrying the whole thing, since its inception. So how is that supposed to help anybody by putting everybody on the same currency? Didn't it really benefit these various countries to be on their own currency, where it's like, yeah, an American dollar, an English pound, or a German mark will buy a lot in whatever country you're talking about, and it's good. They like it when you come down here and spend money.
Yeah.
Rather than put everybody on the same currency, this makes no sense to me. This looks like a deliberate attempt at financial enslavement, but that's just me.
Well, I think that at the time, I think one has to keep in mind, what was the mindset in Europe at the time that the European Union was sort of being put into place? And of course, it wasn't put in place overnight. It started as a kind of economic collaboration of, I think, six different countries, and evolved into what it is that we see today. But the underlying motivation, of course, was it wasn't economic. It was political. They wanted to create some kind of a alliance, if you like, or a union.
All right.
To prevent another world war.
Ah, perfect. That's a perfect place to stop. Let's take our hard break and come back with Dr. John Casti, X Events, The Collapse of Everything, on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're talking tonight with Dr. John Casti, X Events, The Collapse of Everything. And death by physics. blown away. I'll tell you what, this is a wacky planet, isn't it? All right, then. Well, happy Father's Day out there to all to whom that applies. And we'll carry on with Dr. Casting. We'll get into some more of these things. Can't be that bad, really. We're only running out of oil, potentially running out of food. You know, there's a planet back there lurking around. I don't think we're going to get into that. And then there's the possibility of the electromagnetic pulse, which I suppose you can make a case for Coast to Coast AM being an electromagnetic pulse. It's the good pulse. We'll be right back. This is Coast. Dr. John Casty, author of several books, including the new one, X Events, The Collapse of Everything. You know, a couple of times I've mentioned that trouble usually comes from where you least expect it. And in your book, X Events, you mentioned the little trucker strike in Italy that was largely ignored by the press. And I've often thought that that's probably a two-day trucker strike. Big one would be enough to mess things up pretty badly around here when these supermarkets all of a sudden ran empty. Because there would be as soon as the word got out there was a strike, of course, there'd be a run on the stores. And this all leads to the petroleum question. And there's a chapter in your book section about running out of oil. Do you mean by that physically running out of oil, or just it's become so expensive because of the gouging that seems to have come under some controls in this country recently? It was getting pretty expensive there for a while, but, you know, people complained, but they kept going, and then the prices came back down. The supplies are higher than they have been since we began keeping records on it, and I think 81. So what's up with this running out of oil thing? What are your various takes on this?
Well, basically, that chapter is focused on the broader question of literally draining out from underneath the earth all of the oil that was accumulated over millions of years in the decay of organic products, mostly plants. And there are those who would argue that we have passed the halfway point already. And, of course, you never know when you've passed the halfway point until you actually get past it and then start looking back and you say, oh, yeah, the peak really was back here.
Yeah, the pump's not moving anything, so we must be out.
Yes, well, it necessarily will happen at some point. The only issue, the question that's at issue is exactly when. Has it happened already, or is it decades or even centuries into the future? The oil companies and a lot of people who have vested interest in the current petroleum-based economies will argue the latter. They'll say, look, you know, there's plenty of places yet to explore, Antarctica, under the Arctic Ocean, far offshore, and discoveries are made. You know, you see them reported in the newspaper every day, or not every day, but often. But these are only, let's say, hope to put you into, they're only staving off the day of accounting. And in the end, if we're going to actually maintain the kind of societies that we currently enjoy today or hope to enjoy tomorrow, new sources of energy are going to have to be found, and sustainable energy sources. Oil is not a sustainable energy source. And in fact, it's pretty interesting, in my opinion, to realize that the first petroleum was actually only discovered in the mid-1800s, you know, 150 years ago. In that period of time, we have developed this enormous infrastructure that is crucially just dependent on the availability of cheap petroleum. And, of course, part of the story then is if you've already passed the halfway point, even though there might be a lot left, it's not going to be so cheap. And as time goes on, it will become increasingly expensive until it finally runs out. In fact, the whole society will collapse, actually, really long before it runs out if we don't solve the sustainable energy problem. And so that's the story of that chapter in X Events, in the book X Events, is, well, how do we stand? Why do people believe that we are at the peak has already passed, terms of oil production. And what does it mean if oil becomes $10 a gallon at the pump, and you know $200 a gallon at the a barrel? I'm sorry, $200 a barrel. You know, on the exchange market, commodities markets. So that's my story in that chapter.
Dr. Casti, as I went through your book, I noticed that that overpopulation did not have a section of its own, because I suppose that's tied to so many things. I mean, the food and the oil and everything else. But just a couple of guys talking here in the presence of a few million of our closest friends.
Yeah.
What is your take on the overpopulation? I mean, we're not overpopulated yet, but we've got over 7 billion, and it's predicted to go higher.
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me say that that choice that I made of those 11 topics that you actually see in part two of my book, X Event, was made on two grounds. First of all, I wanted to pick things that, to some degree, were less well chronicled than many of the others. That's why there's not a chapter there about global warming. There's not a chapter about overpopulation. There is one about energy, as you've just pointed out. So it's a kind of mixture of the offbeat, like exotic particles sucking up the earth, or electromagnetic pulse, and stuff that has been in and out of the literature or the news media through the years, like problems of peak oil, energy problems. So I was restricted in the number. I mean, I have a list here in my computer of maybe 35 or 40 different
things. That's what I was thinking.
Could have. And in fact, what you actually see in the book, I actually wrote, I think, 15 chapters, and four of them are actually written, and they're still sitting in my computer, and maybe they'll get recycled someday in some form, somewhere. But the cut got made to make it 11 for the book. Now, as far as overpopulation, it was not one of the chapters that I actually wrote and tucked away in the computer, but my sense is that the Earth still can sustain its, not only its current population, but it can sustain probably another 5-6 billion people. But it certainly can't sustain it in the current form. In terms of energy availability, food, water, and so on. And
yeah, we probably would be not driving 12 miles to the gallon cars.
Or any car at all.
that's where I thought you might be headed.
But that's something for some people would say, if I make that kind of remark in polite company, they'll say, look, you're just talking about science fiction. You have too many science fiction books on yourself. But funny thing about science fiction, and I know this from reading all those many books, is that science fiction often has a way of today's science fiction becomes tomorrow's scientific fact. And there's a lot of good speculation. In fact, in many ways, I would rather talk to a good science fiction author than to a good academic, because they usually have a little bit more imagination. And it's imagination that counts for the future.
Well, you know, that's what I was getting at a while ago when I said, are we like visualizing weirdness here that is now being manifest into our reality? And with some of the science fiction that's been written, have we just, I mean, the latest craze is zombies.
Yeah, zombies. Well, it's hard for me to take that seriously as science fiction, although it has maybe some entertainment value. You know, you think about those old Dracula movies with Bela Lugosi or things of that kind, but it's a kind of recycling of an old theme. So, but I don't call that, I don't think we're turning into zombies. I think some of our economies are turning into zombies, you know, sort of the living dead, but the humans as a organic species, not. But you did notice, I think, in my book, there is a chapter about robotic takeover, let's say, of which, again, many people would think of it as a heavy science fiction, and but I don't. I think that the day will come when machines will regard us as probably nice pets.
Yeah, it's interesting. I can't remember who did this. It's been many years ago. But somebody was saying, yeah, the court system will be a computer. You'll go before the computer, it'll analyze everything, and you may walk out of there, and you may wind up being vaporized.
Well, that's it's not literally impossible. Some variant of that might be plausible. I think that you go to a courtroom where a computer that has some sense of empathy and feeling analyzes your case. So that might not be so bad, actually. Not much different than what we have today. But depends on which courtroom you're talking about, which part
right.
of the world.
Well, I was thinking the criminal court. There'd be a world government by then. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
It'd be run by computer, and they'd all be talking to each other.
That world government will, I think, end up being a big version of the European Union.
And, you know, that's what I'm thinking. There are just too many variables there.
There are too many players in the game with too many conflicting interests and shifting interests to imagine that, you know, I think that the only way something even vaguely like a world government might be sustainable is if there were a credible external threat, namely through some alien invasion, for example. It would take something that all human beings would have to unite together in the same feeling that we've got to defend ourselves against this threat, otherwise we're in trouble. We're not in trouble. We're gone.
Yeah, you know, Ronald Reagan said that that'd be the one thing that would unite us is a threat from outside this world.
Yes, yes. And in fact, it's an amusing speculation, which has certainly also appeared in science fiction literature, to think of some human-based organization that manufactures what looks like an alien threat in order exactly for this purpose.
Do you think maybe they're doing that now?
We'll have to have another three-hour conversation about conspiracy theories and government cover-ups and so on. I personally don't believe in most of them. I don't believe in. Some have maybe a marginal evidence in support, but I'm not a conspiracy theorist in general.
No, I like a good old bona fide conspiracy. Those theories, you know, you can just make up anything you want.
You can make up anything. That's right. And they're impossible to disprove. That's part of their attraction, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's that's interesting. I talked with a fellow not too many months ago, and he had told me that he'd been involved in various projects, and had in fact some UFO experience. And I said, "Really, ours or theirs?" And he started laughing. And I thought,
maybe
okay,
you said both.
Yep, I have a feeling it was both. All right, well, you know, I don't see an alien invasion listed here. Yeah, as
no,
a possible
it's
X event.
One of the chapters that I wrote, but still sitting in my computer.
Come on.
Yeah, really.
You got to get that second edition out next year or something.
Maybe it will be in an expanded edition.
Mm-hmm,
you get enough
perfect.
Of your listeners to go out and buy this edition, and I'm sure the publisher will ask for X Events expanded edition, and those chapters will then appear.
Well, let's see, we've got 5-6 minutes here. What is the least likely of the potential civilization-altering events, the X events, which seems to be, it's on the scope, but it's probably the least likely.
That one that I put on, of the 11 that I put in the book, yeah, that the least likely one, in my view, is having the Earth swallowed up by some exotic particles.
Because of some folly at Brookhaven Labs.
Yeah, or at CERN outside Geneva, that somebody has an experiment that goes completely out of control and creates a black hole, which then all of a sudden, or some even stranger kind of particle. And I've described that in that chapter, how in principle that could happen. The physicists cannot say this is impossible. So one might even make the argument to say anything that's not explicitly impossible must happen eventually. And I've seen that argument, but eventually might be a very long time, or it might be in some other part of the galaxy. In any case, in this planet that we live in today, I think the likelihood of a particles swallowing up the Earth is the least likely of the 11 scenarios that I point out in that chapter, in that section of X events.
The scariest part of all of that is these fellows are about to push the initiation button, and somebody will say, wait a minute, this might involve the entire known reality. Well, hold on a minute. Let me make some calculations. No, I think it'll be okay. Are you sure? Pretty sure. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the way it is. People thought that at the time of the Manhattan Project, when the atomic bomb was being developed in Los Alamos, when the first one was ready for testing down in the desert at Alamogordo, there the physicists at Los Alamos, they actually worried about this thing igniting the atmosphere and setting off a huge firestorm around the globe.
Yeah, you're sure the chain reaction is going to stop with the uranium, right?
Yeah. And so if you back of the envelope calculations and the pressure of being engaged in a hot war with Japan and a few other things, they basically said, look, we spent a lot of money on this thing. We got to try it out. And so they set it off. Nothing happened.
We spent a lot of money on this thing. We got to try it out.
Yeah, there you go. You could say the same thing about the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. It's a multi-billion-dollar piece of equipment.
So, which yielded some good things, though, hasn't it?
Well, so far. I mean, it's given some early warning signals that maybe some fundamental questions in particle physics can get resolved by this, but no questions have been definitively answered yet, but it hasn't been fired up at full power yet either.
Oh, brother.
There you are.
Do you happen to know at what power it's running approximately, or would you hazard a guess? 60% maybe?
Something like that. Yeah. In the mid-range. But I think that sometime in the coming autumn, it's scheduled to get ramped up to its full design capacity.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Beforehand.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what the effect would be.
Well, it could be we all disappear in a microsecond.
Yeah, that Philadelphia thing we wind up sticking up out of a ship deck or something.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I don't get this. You know, it's, I want to, well.
Have a look at that chapter in X Events. Then you'll see a little bit more of the sketch of what some people fear. In fact, some guy even initiated some legal action, I think somebody living in Hawaii, to stop the whole process until it could be definitively proved, which could never be done, of course, that this would not happen, that we would not get swallowed up by some particle created there.
If I hear somebody talk about free energy, we just got a couple of minutes here, so we'll just muse around for a second. But, you know, I keep hearing, oh, free energy, zero-point energy. I was talking with a really bright engineer, a scientist, a rational man named Vince Mazur. I met him and spoke with him. And, in fact, he builds one of the Geiger counters that we offer. And he said, I believe that energy is everywhere. I really believe that there are alternative energy sources that are real. Of course, you know, you can go on, just to amuse yourself, you can go onto the internet and see all kinds of stuff that's supposed to, oh, it's free energy, but it's like, that's not really the case. I mean, energy can change form, so you've got to start with something. And I know being in the field that you're in, particularly as a mathematician, you must talk with other professors. Do these alternative energies, is there some promise that there is a real one that civilization, global civilization, might eventually have access to? Or is that one of those things like oil that's like, oh no, this is going to be so tightly controlled, only the elites will get it, and we'll little of it trickle down to you?
Well, first of all, I think there's a little bit of equivocation here on that term free, and the usual meaning in everyday language is at no cost.
Right.
Physicists might use that term very differently, mean energy that's not already being used or encumbered in some way by being bound up in some, let's say, material object, or being bound up in some, so that it's free, it's available.
All right, we're going to bail real quick and do our network break. This is Coast to Coast AM with our guest tonight, Dr. John Casti, X Events, the end of everything.